Thanks so much for joining us here on Radio Free Space on WDRT. We're here with Paul Rattay, the skeptical naturopath, and I'm Christina DeRocher. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Christina. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Fabulous.
Great. What will we be speaking about today?
What do you want to talk about?
Oh, I do remember, though, you wanted to do a correction.
A correction, yes. This is a very important correction. I have to admit that I made a misstep in our last conversation. I talked about putting, I can't believe it's not butter, onto potatoes, if you recall that.
I do remember.
I've been
that.
Corrected by my sister. She actually listened, and she said, those are butter buds. They're not, I can't believe it's not butter. I can't believe not it's not butter. It is a spray that you put on a, you know, that we spray onto the baked potato. Butter buds were the actual shaker.
Oh,
it was
gosh.
The shaker we used. So to be clear, it's butter buds.
Okay, very important.
Thank you.
So our theme today is expert nutrition. And who is an expert?
Yes, who is an expert?
Depends on what the field is, I suppose.
Ah, yes. So this is a big deal in nutrition. Nutrition, we kind of talked about last time, but is it a philosophy? Is it a science? And who do you believe? Who do you trust? Who is going to guide you into what you eat? And I think that the expert world, well, like, what determines an expert? Is it your education? Is it, I'm a naturopathic doctor, so that means you should listen to me because I went to school and I had 8 nutrition classes and that makes me an expert. I have a PhD in nutrition, I run randomized controlled trials, and that means I know about nutrition. Is it because I wrote a diet book? I mean, this is renowned, right? I think I did a search on Amazon and there's 77,000 different popular diet books.
Unbelievable.
Yes, lots of diet books. So is that an expert because I wrote a book and then I kind of hit this responsive chord? Is it in, you know, so what is it that determines that? Is it the government? The government knows what we should eat and they make, proclaim here's what you should follow or here's what the evidence suggests or, you know, how do we put that together and how do we make decisions about what we actually eat? And really, I think that part of it is reflecting away from the expert and reflect more on yourself. Right, so this is the idea that I don't even know what diet is right for you. I may have tendencies, I certainly have biases, but the idea is that, you know, you try it on to see if it fits. And how long do you have to try something on to see if it fits? Plus, who was trying on diets 100 years ago, right? I
was thinking about that before we came on today. There wasn't so much of a choice, right? And so now we have 45 different toothpastes and 65 different cereals. Because originally I was saying, this should be pretty standardized. Really, what grows in your area in the season? What, you know, what's around you? But the problem is our society has gotten so complex and so complicated with food and foodstuffs that now we really do need to think about what is appropriate.
Right. This is part of the nutrition transition, right? So we've transitioned. Our nutrition is transitioned partly based on choice and affluence. And maybe the choice goes along with affluence. So we have more money. We have more money to spend. We buy food. We have to buy food. So the question is how do we capture that dollar? How do we even entice you to spend more money on food? And we give you more choice. And choice, actually, I find to be quite paralyzing.
Right.
There's just too many, and you don't know what to do, and then you don't know what's a good choice or a bad choice. It's the same thing with the diets. There's so many options out there of what diet you should follow. And again, maybe, like we said, it's just what's where do you live right now and what is available right now, and, you know, just shop at the farmer's market, and you can buy all your produce, and, you know, you're going to buy what's in season because when it's not in season,
they can't sell it.
It's not there, right? Because
right.
There's that. But understand that shelf life is a big deal too, right? So the food industry is very interested in having foods that have a long shelf life. They don't want something that's going to rot in 2 weeks. If it rots in 2 weeks, you can't keep it on the shelf.
Right. I guess I want to see all the middle aisles burn then.
The middle aisles, right? Shop the perimeter. That's
right.
Where though now they're getting tricky. They insert the bread in the produce aisle. Right?
Right.
Then you come through and you're like, oh, there's the cinnamon rolls. I want a cinnamon roll with my banana. a very deliberate, right? Deliberate placement in grocery stores. You know, I've often thought that people should go in and test their blood sugar before they go into the grocery store. So if your blood sugar's low, meaning you're potentially hangry, not a good time to shop.
Right. Go to the cafe and get something to eat first.
Eat something first and have a full belly, or at least be not hungry and go shopping. If you're hungry when you shop, bad choices are, well, I shouldn't say bad choices, more choices. You're going to buy more food.
Right, right.
But, you know, the nutrition transition, again, this is just the aspect that we now are in a different place, right? We're excess. We have a lot. We eat a lot of calories. We have a lot of money. We socialize with food. We do all these things, and it's not any different than it was 200 years ago from the eating for energy, eating for social, you know, social interaction. It's a coming together. It's a community. But there's all those other things that come in there. I mean, think of Coke. I think of Coca-Cola and the commercials they put out there, right? So it's, wow, you know, have a Coke with your friend. Right,
yeah.
So this is a gathering thing. So, wow, let's all sit together and poison ourselves all at the same time. Right? That's how I look at that. But they're creating that imagery, right? They create that story, per se, of this is what it means to eat this food. And well, it's very powerful for
and
us.
And the underlying right? message to me is always connection. When there's a beer commercial, they're all having a party.
Yes.
When there's a cereal commercial, all the family is present, right? When there's a... somebody's at work and they're having a hard day and a coworker comes up with a candy bar. Oh, you know, now my coworker loves me and I'm not hangry anymore.
Yes, exactly.
It's all about connection, right? Because we're losing
connection.
We're losing that in our society. And I think, you know, I've watched the Netflix series, The Food That Built America.
Hmm.
It's really fascinating backdrop as to what was going on. It's put on by the History Channel. So there's all this background information about what's happening in the society and why these foods are coming into play. It doesn't always have to do with the milieu around the inventor. Sometimes it's just that he wants to figure out a way, right, to make a living. But the point is that all around them, they are working hard, right? They're all working really hard. It's the Industrial Revolution, and they're developing foods because now families, parents are going away from the home during the day, working in the factories and other positions. And I do feel that even in today's society, we're moving away from that as well. So it becomes even more important to make better choices about our food because we're not all working in factories 40 hours a week. In other words, you know, when we're working office jobs and things like that, do we really need the high calorie, high fat, you know, foods that we may have needed because we were burning it off, working more... laborious jobs.
Are you a tailor or a lumberjack?
Right, right.
What's Paul Bunyan's favorite food? We just had this discussion the other day, Paul Bunyan. Flapjacks, right? And then what's the difference between a flapjack and a pancake?
What is it?
I don't know.
Are they bigger?
I had to come up with, well, this is the conversation with your 11-year-old, right?
Right, but, right.
What is food? But again, it's, you know, are we eating? Why are we eating? Are we eating for energy? Are we eating for social engagement? Are we eating because we're bored? Are we eating because we're stressed? And understand, food acts as a drug for us. Drug, I mean, drug's a strong word, but it has a medicinal value, if you want to say that. Right? Carbohydrates will help spike your serotonin levels. That's kind of a good thing. And serotonin, if you eat those carbohydrates before you go to sleep, it may help you sleep better. But eating them early in the day, maybe doesn't have the same effect. I mean, the other effect of carbohydrates, for example, puts you on the blood sugar roller coaster.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want to end up with the highs and the lows and the highs and the lows. And some of us can eat oatmeal for breakfast and eat carbohydrates for breakfast and drink juice and eat cereal, and we don't have a problem. Other people have a major problem with that. This is the individualization of things. So you have to figure out what works for you. Of all those popular diets that are out there, understand that they're written in a way for you to buy the book. I mean, that's the prime directive, is that you buy the book, not that you follow the book. But they're trying to entice you to say, hey, this is the latest, greatest thing. This is what you need to do. And of all those diet books that continue to get published every year, which ones rise to the top? And some perhaps are somewhat surprising, and then other ones are just kind of the routine. I mean, the publishing industry knows this. There's a recipe that they follow to write a diet book, to produce a diet book, because they want the next best, you know, the latest, greatest, and new shiny diet.
And you found this. Are you going to tell us about this?
Yeah, which one?
Gentleman?
The
Eric Rovelto?
So, of course, I look, right? So, you know, how do you write a diet book? And there's certainly sort of a protocol that you can follow, having a flashy title and, you know, make it sound good and using all the rhetoric. But somebody's actually written a book on that, how to write a diet book.
Amazing.
And it gives you the ideas. What's the exact title of this?
Right? How to write a diet book for fun and profit.
For fun and profit. Wow. So I can write for fun? Writing for me is not fun.
Right.
Speaking different, but writing, like, it's fun. And I'm going to make money on it.
And neither of those have anything to do, in my opinion, with health and diet. I don't think of diet as fun. I think of it as serious. I'm looking for results. I'm looking for better energy, better sleep, you know, better cognition. And I certainly don't want to think that you wrote this book to make money off of me.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's amazing.
Is that why you're writing a book? And how many books are there? Do I just need to write another book that's on top of the heap of self-help books that are out there, or the popular diet books that exist?
Right. And so his outline here, you choose a title, and in that way you pick a trendy place, which made me think of the Mediterranean diet, the South Beach diet, even the Paleo diet is a place in time almost, right? We eat what indigenous people ate or what we ate back in the day. And then you personalize it with your weight loss story, right?
Of course.
You tell them, you know, what you did in order to come to these conclusions that this is what you're supposed to be doing. And people love that. There again is connection. I think you asked earlier when we were talking about the topics, what would be the Viroqua diet,
yeah,
right? To pick a place, what would be the Viroqua diet? My immediate reaction was, it would have to be CSA-based, right? There are so many CSAs in this area. I personally have tried 4 of them in the 7 years that I've lived here, and they're all great, you know? And there's more farmland here than there is hardly, you know, organic farmland and that sort of thing. It's,
yeah, but some people may say it'd be the cheese curd diet.
Oh, gosh, right.
I mean, right. So again, it's different.
And beer, cheese and beer.
Cheese and beer.
There's more bars per capita in this state than anywhere in the
Union. So that's the Viroqua diet. So who are we talking to?
Right.
Who's our audience? Same thing with diet books. When they write a diet book, who are they writing to? Who are they trying? Who is the person in the store that's buying a diet book?
Right.
And they're in a different, I would say, socioeconomic status, for example, than people that may need the information or that could have a bigger impact on their health versus somebody that's just like, well, I want to lose weight or whatever that is. And so this is the type of person that's there, and how do you entice them? You're going to read the back cover. You're going to read about the author. Maybe you go through the table of contents.
Or maybe they're so environmentally friendly or so foodie oriented that you immediately buy in because you've heard of them before, like Michael Pollan. Right,
right, exactly.
Yeah, he already had a following, and then he wrote these books.
Yeah, and he capitalizes on that.
Yeah.
He writes a good book. The Omnivore's Dilemma is a very good book, and then he writes kind of the follow-up to that. And this happens all the time, right? The diet book is popular. Then we have the diet book for children and the diet book for diabetics and the diabetic for plant-based, right? So there's all they're changing the diet based on that. Then the cookbook. And think about these diet books. I mean, how long, how big are they? I mean, they're 300 pages or $26.95.
Yeah.
And seriously, you dissect a diet book, you'll see the pattern that's there, as you said. There's always, like, oftentimes 3 phases. Right? There's the really difficult phase, but don't worry about it. It's not that bad, and you'll feel great. And then there's sort of this kind of, you know, maintenance. Now, how do you transition? And then there's the lifelong plan that you're on, right? The lifelong phase. And
right.
It's just like, oh, it's easy, right? It's put forward to me. It's stage 1, stage 2, stage 3. I'll be there. Great. Watch, you know, look at me go. This reminds me of the stages of change model. I don't know if you're familiar with that. So anybody making a behavior change, they want to stop smoking, they want to, you know, change their diet. There's a kind of a 6-step process on there. The first step is pre-contemplation. So pre-contemplation is, I don't have a problem. Why are you telling me that I need to stop smoking? Right? I don't need to lose weight, right? It's fine, right? That's pre-contemplation.
So before you're thinking before about it, you're thinking, denying it. Really.
You're denying it, right? You're validating, right? You want validation that that's not a problem. Why are you even saying this to me? Next stage is contemplation. So contemplation is, I have a problem. Maybe I need to do something about it. I would say, America, we're great contemplators.
Oh, for sure. We wake up in the morning and go, you know, it would be great if I walked around the block even just once today.
Yes.
And then by 4 o'clock in the evening, oh, you know, now it's almost dinner time. I got to get something on the table. And by 8 o'clock, you know, we're winding down saying, tomorrow.
Yes, exactly. So contemplation is normally, oh, but in 3 months or 6 months, after the holidays, I'll do that. Or, you know, you're putting it out a bit. You know that you need to do something, but you're not quite at that engagement level. That's contemplation.
Yeah.
But at least you're saying something's wrong something and I need to fix it.
And there's a market in books for that as well.
For sure.
Right? Of journaling. Let's get to the heart of what's going on. Oh, it's that you need to have exercise every day? Well, let's think about the ways in which you are blocked from doing that. And then let's think about little tiny steps. Meanwhile, I've spent all day journaling about it, and I could have just gotten outside and taken a walk, right? And I'm making fun of myself here to all the listeners out there, by the way. This is me, totally. I am very cerebral, and I love the idea that I'm going to sit and contemplate it to death without doing it.
Oh, goodness.
No judgment. I'm laughing at myself.
Yes. Contemplation. So the next phase is then the planning phase. And you've heard if you fail to plan, you're planning to fail. And I tend to see patients in that category. They know they're ready. They need a plan. They want to say, now I need the diet. Like, tell me what to eat.
Right.
I want to know that this is what I need to follow. And I'm ready to do it because, you know, everything's ready to go and I just need the plan. So we write the plan up. That's fine. Then there's the action phase. And that's the kind of, wow, look at me go. Like, wow, I'm following this. I feel so much better. Or something along those lines. That's action phase.
Yes. But then January 1st, 2nd, 3rd, maybe 4th, to the 14th.
Yeah, maybe to the 14th. Yes.
And then?
You know, I've heard numbers that meat sales are highest in the United States in January. I'm not quite sure that's still correct, but I've heard that from people working in the natural food industry, that people buy more meat in January than they do any other month of the year. Now, that's interesting.
Yeah, I would think
Thanksgiving, you think the holidays, the Christmas.
Or just the whole winter, that it would be spread out as soon as it starts getting colder, maybe.
So why would they eat more meat in January?
I would think New Year's resolution, now they're freezing it so that they have food on hand because they're trying a new, you know, menu plan where they have more food on the table than they are eating out or something like that.
I think it's everybody's on an Atkins diet.
Okay.
Not everybody, but it's quick fix. I want to lose weight. I want to lose weight now. I don't want to lose weight, or I want to lose it for the wedding in 3 months, or there's some event, or it's January, so it's just time to get on the, get, you know, to stand up and say, now it's time to do something. So they all go on an Atkins diet. And again, that's not necessarily true. It's all Atkins, but understand lower carbohydrate diets.
Lower carbs, right.
So it's just like, I got to get rid of the carbs. I got to get rid of the carbs. So they do that, and they follow it for a month, 2 weeks, 6 weeks, I don't know, and then they go back to what they were doing before. So they do this really aggressive diet, and they may lose some weight. Maybe they feel better. Now, interesting, from my perspective, I care about the feeling better.
Yes.
I don't care necessarily about the weight loss. The weight loss should come as a result of you feeling better.
Right.
But I need you to feel better. You come in with fatigue, I'm really interested in doing things to try to help you, you know, improve your energy production.
Indeed.
And is that eating different? Perhaps. But, you know, where does the rubber hit the road? So you can do all sorts of aggressive types of things, right? So you go on a keto diet, you go on the Atkins diet, you feel better and you lose some weight. But the question is how you're going to maintain that, right? So that's the next stage, right, after the action phase is the maintenance. How do you maintain those changes that you've made? I'm going to tell you, really difficult. If you go extreme on either direction, whether it's low fat, whether it's low carb, you're going to start to stray, right? You'll stray towards low fat diets will start to eat more fat. Low carb diets will start to eat more carbohydrates, what we call regress to the mean. The mean being, you know, 15% protein, 55% carbohydrate, and what's left on that, 30% fat.
And so is that what we're looking for, really, is the mean?
Yeah, is that the mean? So we just are going to regress to it. So we're doing something. Wow, look at me go, but I can't maintain it.
Right.
Like, oh, I'm following the low-carb diet, but, you know, I really want some fruit, or I want a piece of chocolate, or I want to eat some chocolate cake, or whatever it is. And the idea is, well, I can't eat that, right? It becomes a black and white thing. You read a diet book, and they're giving you sort of black and white, like good food, bad food.
Mm-hmm.
That's bad. This is good.
And just the psychology of telling someone they can't right off the bat, you know, quitting smoking is the same. I can't smoke versus, you know, a lot of people I know who try to quit, they have to reframe it into an empowering statement like, I choose not to. And so this whole idea of good food, bad food, it just automatically sets you off like you're in a war. Very difficult to maintain.
Wrong metaphor. The war metaphor doesn't work.
Right.
Like you're fighting. We have this diet fighting that diet, or which one's best. You know, it's a dance.
Mm-hmm.
We have to dance, and we have to dance and say, okay, well, we have to figure this out, and it's a trial and error thing, and there's maybe some give and take, and it's not just all carbs are bad or all fat is bad, but that how do we sort of dance with these foods? How do they make us feel? Looking at it from that perspective rather than, oh, it's black and white. Now, the black and white becomes somewhat easier to do, like you don't have to think about it. I can't eat this. I can eat this. I can't eat that. Again, I'll use keto as an example. It's an all-you-can-eat bacon buffet. Like, I can eat all the bacon I want. But people generally, after 2 weeks, will say, oh, my God, I don't want to eat another piece of bacon. I can't stand it. Like, you're telling me to eat bacon, but I don't want it. And on some level, I'm like, well, maybe that's a good thing. Now you don't want to eat, so how much are you eating? Maybe you've cut things, you know, you're eating less because you're not eating carbohydrates. Maybe it has nothing to do with the fat you're eating. Maybe it just has to do with the fact that something about a low carbohydrate diet lowers your calorie consumption.
Which is a good thing.
We see that,
right.
Which is a good thing. And again, how long are you going to continue on that? But again, is it the goal just the calorie restriction? Again, on a keto diet or even on an Ornish diet or a very low-fat diet, both of those say you don't have to count your calories. This isn't about counting calories. This is just about following the rules.
Right.
And if you follow the rules.
You can eat as much as you want as – you can eat as much as you want of the good foods.
Correct. And what's a good food for one is not a good food for the other. But what's interesting when you look at – again, I just use Atkins and Ornish as the extremes, Ornish being – fat less than 10%, Atkins being carbohydrates less than 5%. So those are extreme.
Yeah, that
right?
is.
So those are
less than
extreme.
5%.
But I do this in the classroom and I say, well, what do they have in common? Hopefully they don't listen. If they listen to this, they may know the answer. I ask this on an exam. So what does the Atkins diet and the Ornish diet have in common?
High protein.
Maybe high protein. It's not necessarily. Understand that if you're on an Ornish diet, you're going to eat lots of carbohydrates.
Oh, right.
If you're on an Atkins diet, you're going to eat lots of fat.
Okay.
So protein isn't necessarily high or low. And generally, they look at that protein may go up a little bit, but on average, it's really not protein. So what do they have in common?
I guess I'd fail your exam. I don't know.
Well, students always say, oh, well, they're both restricting a macronutrient. I'm like, yeah, that's not in common.
Okay.
That's an answer I get. But honestly, Ornish is going to take out some of those, again, I'm sorry, I use this, the bad carbohydrates. What I would say is refined carbohydrates. So you go on an Ornish diet, he's not telling you to go eat candy. You could theoretically eat candy because it's low fat.
Oh, right.
So it's an okay food, but they're going to say, yeah, but we want to be careful on those carbohydrates. We want you to eat whole grains. We want you to not have added sugar, you know, maybe not fruit juice, depending on which one you look at, but eat a piece of fruit. But on some level, they're taking out the quote-unquote crappy carbohydrates.
Which is what Atkins
has. Atkins
had in the
automatically takes
right.
that out.
Right.
Now understand then the other piece is what about the crappy fats? When what's a crappy fat? I'm going to say it's again a refined oil, right? A refined oil that's been processed that I have issues with. If it hasn't, you know, the more that we mess with it to extract corn oil or soybean oil from these plants, I can't do that in my kitchen. I'm going to call that a bad fat.
Mm-hmm.
So you could theoretically eat them on Atkins on an Atkins diet. You could eat those bad fats. But generally, where do we find the bad fats?
in bad carbohydrate.
Exactly. Mean, bad carbohydrates and bad fats go together. Right. You find them together. Chips, snack food. And again, maybe we lower the fat a little bit, or we raise the fat a little bit, or we lower the carbs a little bit. They change it. But generally speaking, those foods go together.
Right.
So if you cut out the carbs, the bad fat goes along with it.
So
totally true. And again, you can eat bacon. Is bacon a good fat or a bad fat? We could argue about that for a long time. And bacon is not a health food. Let's be clear about that. But it's still not a carbohydrate, so you eat it, but it's still processed to a certain degree, right? But I think that, again, we debate whether that's the good fat or that's a bad fat. I'm going to say it's still not something that we've gone in there and extracted an oil from a plant that we couldn't do. In other words, we've been eating bacon for a long period of time.
Indeed. Right?
Bacon's not new. Does that make it good because we've been eating it? It's just not a new food that I'm going to say, wow, and I have this precautionary principle. Maybe I'm a culinary conservative.
Okay.
I go backwards and I say, well, what we used to eat, I'm not going to blame for things. But that's being somewhat conservative, that perhaps science has some answers and there's some new thing that's going to help save me. I'm skeptical on that. I'm very skeptical on that. So maybe I'm a culinary conservative. But again, it's trying to figure out what these diets have in common and what are we really trying to achieve here. So it's not a question of whether bacon is good or bad. You eat bacon because you can, because it tells you that that's all right on there. But then, like I said, maybe you get sick of eating bacon and you're like, I don't want to eat any more bacon. Or perhaps you're on a low-fat diet and you say, oh, well, I don't want to eat any more oatmeal, right? I don't know. But again, we're putting these labels out there, and this is the piece of saying, look, this is what you follow. You don't have to cut your calories. Just follow the rules, follow the food rules, and you'll be good to go. And I think that that can work, but you're being very aggressive. You've made dramatic changes to your diet. So the maintenance phase becomes very difficult.
The long haul.
The long haul.
Yes.
And the maintenance part is where people fall down for the most part. They can't maintain those changes.
Because it hasn't become a dance at that point.
Yes.
It's become a lockstep. These are the rules. You stay within these parameters. And so if you can't, then you're not going to get the same results. And there's a psychological aspect too. You know, once you've fallen off, right, then it's not, people don't, when they're doing a diet and they quote unquote fall off, they don't necessarily have a lot of self-forgiveness or compassion with themselves, and that can be a spiral as well. I had a friend once who ate ice cream for a straight week after, you know, we had been macrobiotic together and she had experienced various things in her life and decided that she was going to just fall off the wagon intentionally. And for her, that meant eating ice cream for like a solid week on and off. And she ate other foods too. But she didn't feel great by the end of that week. She was very emotional. You know what I'm saying? And so I think there's something to what you said about having it be a more gentle dance, more sustainable. There's a psychology behind that as well, not just the physical attributes. Even getting better energy and, you know, eating less, those are great. But do you feel good? How do you feel? And that can be beyond the physical. It can be psychological as well.
Absolutely. So let's go back to the stages of change. So when you're in maintenance phase and you fail, you fall off the bandwagon, where do you go? Do you go back to action phase? Do you go back to maintenance? Or do you go to planning phase?
Right.
Do you go back to contemplation?
No. Yeah.
Where do you go? Pre-contemplation.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't have a problem. Why did I do that? Oh, that diet didn't work.
Or it's too hard.
It's
they
too
just
hard.
Throw in the towel, right? So we're going to take a quick break here and acknowledge that we are on the Radio Free Space on WDRT with the skeptical naturopath, the food conservative, Paul Rattay.
The culinary conservative.
Yes.
Oh, goodness. So I do want to make a comment, too, about now... I see people, I see patients, they come in, what do I eat? And here, we can try this on. And people are willing to give me 2-4 weeks, something along those lines, right? I need a 30-day detox, or I need to, you know, I need to clean up, I need to do these things. That they'll give me some time and they'll say, I'm willing to do this, I'm ready to change. I'm like, okay, let's go for it. And again, my goal is to get them feeling better quickly. So we do something, and I will tell them that I'm giving you something that's not a long-term diet, or it's very difficult for you to maintain this for 6 months. So I'm giving you a plan that's basically an experiment. And it's an experiment to say, you don't feel good now. Here's the things that you're doing. Let's make a change, my engineer nature. Let's tweak a variable and see if that makes a difference.
A boot camp.
Boot camp. And then I give them a list. You can eat this, you can't eat this. And understand, it's not always the same thing. But I generally do more low carbohydrate because I found, my experience, that's the quickest way to get people to feel better. I think they could get that on a low fat diet too. I just think it's harder. I think it's easier to go low carb and feel better. Of course, and then I tell them even before they start kind of what I predict is going to happen, and that the likelihood of them staying on this diet that I give them for a short period of time, 6 months from now, is less than 5%. So the idea is it's not a 6-month diet. It's not a 20-year diet. But the goal is 20-year diet, right? Like, what am I going to eat for the next 20 years? What am I going to eat for the next 40 years? How am I going to live my life to determine how I deal with things that happen along the way? I mean, how many times does your diet change in the next 20 years? I mean, talking about my diet, how much has changed over the last 20 years?
I did want to talk about that. So, speaking of dancing, you are quite the dance partner
here.
Yeah,
for sure. but anyway, so I see people, and it's the conversation to say, this is just boot camp, or this is an experiment to see if you feel better.
Right. And soldiers do not live in boot camp. Right?
Yeah, they don't live in boot camp.
They move on.
Exactly.
That was a helpful step to the process, but they don't live in that space.
But if people feel better in a short period of time, now that's important. So let's say before you fall off the before you get to maintenance, because I know that, but I'm not necessarily following people and holding their hand all the way to get them through maintenance. I suppose I could do that. But generally, they come to me because they want a plan.
Right.
What's the plan? I need to follow something. Great, let's do it. Let's see what happens. And then we work on that. And before they get back to pre-contemplation, we go back to, okay, well, maybe now we need to make a new plan. No, so how are we going to engage, and how are you going to engage going forward to say, you don't have to be under 25 grams of carbohydrates every day. Let's figure out where you need to dance with the carbohydrates,
right.
If that makes sense.
No, absolutely. What's your threshold?
Yeah, what's your threshold?
Before you start to feel crappy by the end of the week.
And understand that's hard because your carbohydrate content may change a bit, because now it's, well, you can eat fruit. Fruit's not a bad food, but it goes out because it's got carbohydrates in it. Or you can't eat a sweet potato, right? I'm not too concerned about sweet potatoes.
Right.
But the idea is still a carbohydrate. You start eating that, and then now it becomes a rationing game. Because now you're like, well, how much sweet potato can I eat? And if I'm going to eat a piece of cake, how much cake are you going to eat? Do you need 2 bites? Do you need the half a pan? And again, where did that cake come from? Because I'm going to tell you, if it came from the grocery store, I'm not eating it.
Uh-uh.
It's got the film in my mouth. I'm like, I just wasted some of my sugar carbohydrate content on what I would call not so good food.
Yeah, right? That's how I think of it too, actually. Right. I'd rather make something at home that's good quality and eat more of it than spend the money to go to a grocery store and get the less quality stuff and know that I really shouldn't eat as much of it at all.
Like, what's that taste? Ugh. It's the film in my mouth, right? And like, what is that?
Right.
You look at the ingredient list and you're like, wow.
Oh, well, no doubt.
Wow.
There's 20 ingredients in this. One of those is creating that film, or at least, you know, maybe 2 or 3 of them.
And the food industry is really interested these days in what they call clean label. Have you heard clean label?
No, but
so
I
clean label
know
means
going,
that they're
sure.
putting ingredients on there that look clean.
Yes.
So they'll use, what's an example, citrus fiber. And that can be hidden as other things that are, you know, preservatives or additives or something they're using, but it falls under that because it's only made with citrus fiber. And you see citrus fiber, you're like, that's not a big deal.
Right.
But still a manufactured item that they're using for mouthfeel or for texture or for something, right? Some kind of, not necessarily flavoring, but some additive that they're trying to accomplish with the food.
Yeah. I don't know if that would ever be a full radio show, but that's
clean
such
label.
An interest. Seriously, the whole marketing campaign and what's allowed, I think it's really an underrepresented topic in the sense that if most people knew what was actually going on in the food industry, you just wouldn't shop in those middle aisles. You just wouldn't.
You just wouldn't.
It's not worth the risk of what is that thing. You know, it goes back to the fact that they release cleaning products at warp speed and then they have to retract some after things happen. You know what I'm saying? And I think it's the same in the food industry.
But those foods are cheap. They're tasty.
And they're reusing the corn and the soy that we have a plethora of, right? Everything has corn in it. A lot of things have soy in them. And you say to yourself, well, why? You know, I have pet rats. And one of the things you look for when you, if you do buy a pellet for them, which I did when they were younger, now they eat my food, right? Everything is fresh and they love it. They won't go back to pellets now. There you go. But the pellets, you know, what they said to look for was something that didn't have, quote, filler in it. And what is filler? It's corn and soy. And they have it in dog food and cat food the same. They start with the filler and then they go into chicken and lamb and fish and beef and all the things you think you want in your, or you do want in your pet food. But look at the label. There's filler in there and it's a lot. It's actually quite a bit. And it's because we have this corn and soy obsession and we have to figure out ways to use the rest of it, so to speak. You know?
And the shelf life obsession with that too, because those foods are things that we can turn into something that has a shelf life of 10 years or whatever.
Right.
Whereas if it's a piece of meat or a piece of fruit, or it's going to rot.
That's right.
And if it doesn't, maybe that's our definition of real food. If it doesn't rot, don't eat it.
Yeah.
How long does it take to rot? The longer it takes to rot,
the more it should be on your list.
Exactly.
The more represented it should be in your diet.
So that hamburger that from the fast food restaurant that's still the same 1 year later, 2 years later, probably not a good choice. But you look at the individual ingredients, you're like, wow, that's okay, right? I mean, what's wrong with that? Oh, that's all right.
Yeah, it's the preservatives a lot of the time, right?
Yes.
So let's talk about your diet journey because I have a number of questions. I think it's really interesting, and a lot of people who want a big change in their life and do perhaps see people who do have a degree, who have letters after their name, or who have studied nutrition for any amount of time. I mean, you seem to have both worlds going on. You have not only the degree behind your name and a lot of experience teaching and being in your field, but you also have your own personal dietary experience. And so I would hesitate not to call you an authority of some sort, especially because your message is what's about you, right? You're not saying, oh, well, yes, after all of my experience, I know that this is what's going to work and that this is what's sustainable. What I hear you say again and again is we're all different. We need to make it a dance. We need to have a deep conversation with how we're feeling. We need to recognize that what we did in boot camp isn't necessarily going to be sustainable, and that goes back to the dance quality. And so I do think it's very interesting that you have 10 diets over the last 30 years. So tell us about that.
10 different trends on that.
Yeah.
And again, people should see me. They should ask me, instead of asking me questions like, can you help me? Like, what's in your refrigerator? Will you show me a picture of your pantry? And then I'll make a judgment call on, do you actually practice what you preach? Are you, you know, a closet carbohydrate consumer?
Well, let's go there. How much cereal?
Let's go there. Yeah, how much cereal? Cereal for sure is my weak point, yes? I mean, cereal, I was raised on cereal. Honey Nut Cheerios, I'm sure there were days that's all I ate. Breakfast, lunch, dinner. Gallon of milk and the big box Honey Nut Cheerios. And understand, my mom wouldn't buy sugar-sweetened cereal. My dad would, but that only happened once every 3 months. But my mom, it was as far as she would go would be Life cereal or Honey Nut Cheerios.
Right.
Like, that was the threshold.
The ones that said, you know, 5 grams of sugar, right, serving or
but
whatever.
But not Frosted Flakes.
No.
But interesting enough, you can take corn flakes and make them into Frosted Flakes. just add sugar.
Right.
Yeah. And then the milk tastes sweet and you got the whole thing going. Yes.
It's funny that you say that. I wonder about myself when I say things like, but I'm a child of the 80s, but I spent all my allowance on candy. So of course I have a tendency to XYZ, right? Because I grew up on cereal too. And I could care less. I really could. So it's funny that that's your thing.
It's the crunch. It's the convenience. It's the cereal box. Perhaps it was the prize that was in there ago, right?
Sure.
You remember that? You'd dig the prize out, and then the box balloon because all the cereal's on the bottom. You kind of have to shake that up.
Never close the same again.
So close, because then they'd know, oh, who took the toy out of there? Because I have my brother and sister. Like, who's going to get the toy?
Oh, man. I absolutely remember all of that.
Regardless. So cereal is an issue.
Okay.
Yes?
It's your Achilles heel.
But I don't really buy it. And I've learned, right? I buy the Ezekiel cereal that's kind of like Grape Nuts. It's not quite the same. Like, I love Grape Nuts too, but it's the crunch, right? So I'm a crunch guy. There's a texture thing.
And those cereals are really crunchy, Ezekiel and Grape Nuts.
Yes, correct.
I mean, they're all about crunch.
Correct. And I think Ezekiel perhaps is better. Right, but does it make it good for me? I'm not sure, but it's still the aspect of I've got the bowl of cereal, there's the bowl, there's the spoon, there's the cereal box, there's the crunch, how long do you let it sit in the milk, or in our case it's not milk, it's oat milk or what have you, the alternative on that.
And do you make your own oat milk?
I don't make my own oat milk.
Mm,
so the oat milk, now again, we can have a whole conversation of where's your oat milk coming from and who's made that? And is that like a validation to say, oh, oat milk is healthy?
No,
it's not. It's now it's not a health food. It's a replacement food. So
right.
we run into that problem all of the time. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we're like, oh, well, I don't drink milk. I drink this and it's got as much calcium and other things. Like, well, how did calcium get in the oat milk? They put the calcium in
right.
it. It's not naturally there.
And so what's the quality of that calcium?
Exactly, right?
Mm-hmm.
So again, so I got some oat milk that wouldn't pass the judgment on that in my house. Yes?
It wouldn't pass my snuff. I do rice milk and soy milk occasionally, right? It's a fun food in our house. We don't drink it regularly, but neither one of them have any sugar. And as far as I know, I'll order oat milk before I'll order some other kind of milk that they offer, almond milk. Because I know it has less sugar, but it's not sugar-free. I'd be willing to bet your oat milk has sugar added to it.
Well, it's not. I mean, it's not on the label. So it's
isn't?
Unsweetened.
Oh,
yeah,
it
the
is unsweetened.
Yeah,
okay.
Oh, for sure. But I worry about seed oils. I worry about what they're doing to get the creaminess in it. And
right.
I can tell you there's additives to it, and it's still a clean label thing, right? Guar gum in there or
mm-hmm.
something. And I haven't done my due diligence to say, what's that guar gum being used as, and is it something else that they're just getting that creamy texture from that?
Can I posit why you haven't done that? You're in the precognition phase.
Pre-contemplation.
Oh,
there's
Excuse
nothing
me.
Wrong. I'm a naturopath. This is what I eat. I only eat good, clean food.
No,
yes.
This is my one vice, and I'm not going to investigate it because I need it to stay pure in my mind so that I don't feel guilty when I imbibe in it because I only do the cereal, right? Like, I have certain things in my life where I'm like, yeah, I know, but it's like one of my only things that I eat that's pretty, you know, off the charts. It's not really good for me, but it's the only thing. And so I don't even look at the label anymore. I'm sure I did it one. Oh, like the fake Pringles at the co-op, right? Every once in a while, especially if they're on sale, I'll get those Pringles from my childhood, right? And this is the natural food kind, right? I'm sure I looked at the label at one time and decided, no, it's not going to just kill me out of hand. So yes, okay, I'll have them occasionally. But I don't look at the label anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And then the reply to that is, well, I don't eat that much.
Right.
It's moderation, right? I can eat a little bit of, I can drink a little bit of oat milk.
Yeah, right.
And again, how often am I eating cereal? I will tell you, though, that I also have this thing that I don't want to waste food. This is something my mom taught me at an early age, right? Starving children in China clean your plate. And there was, you know, wow, there was a shortage of the goulash that she made, right? Which, I don't know, did I say the goulash story last week?
No.
That'll come future. I'm not going to say it now. But anyways, goulash, the elbow macaroni with cream of tomato soup and ground beef and onions, and it's not goulash.
I know
right?
the one,
you know,
yes.
The hot dish. Regardless, so we'll occasionally go and, you know, my wife will be somewhere, specifically Whitaker's in Hillsborough.
Oh, yeah, I know the place.
And you can buy cereal really cheap there, yes? She bought a huge box of Honey Nut Cheerios. I'll tell you, it's in the house right now. I mean, she paid like $2 for it. And I'm looking for a deal, right? This really gets me too, right? I was raised that way. Like, you need to shop the sales.
Find the deals.
Yeah, find the deals. So we have this big box of Honey Nut Cheerios in my house. But I will tell you, it's been there for quite a while. I don't even really eat it. Now it's there, but it's sad. The Ezekiel cereal will be more likely, but I got to make sure that I have the Ezekiel cereal there so that I don't eat the Honey Nut Cheerios. And honestly, that's not always our go-to. It's not like every night, but it's on occasion we're like, let's have a bowl of cereal.
So,
right? I mean, this is a deal, right? So now I'm fostering this crappy carbohydrate, but then I'll say, well, I eat it at night. It's going to increase my serotonin levels. It's not working on my blood sugar roller coaster. I can rationalize everything.
Me too. Yep. I can relate to that.
But there is cereal in my house, and I'd say that's not good. But I sat there for quite a while. I'm actually kind of proud it's been there for a while. Now, I'm telling you that story. Right now, if I was eating it all the time, I'd be like, oh. Talk about that. And oat milk too, right? Oat milk. I mean, we get the oat milk. We don't get it with the seed oil in it, but it's still got other things in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not that I'm drinking it by the glass. It's not that eating cereal to have that, but there's a sense that we'll make whatever we make. My wife's all obsessed with matcha now. So she heats up the oat milk and the little heater that we have, or we'll make hot chocolate with it or something. And then we use it, but it's not that it's being drunk like like a gallon of milk that I drank when I was a kid.
Once a week.
Oh my
goodness. Depending on the size of your family.
A gallon of milk and a huge box of Honey Nut Cheerios and sign me up. I'm good to go.
Right.
Yes. Anyway, so that's something in my house that I'm not necessarily proud of.
Seed oils?
I have avocado oil there that is refined. I think it's refined. I get it from Costco. We just had this conversation about should I buy the avocado oil from Costco because it's still refined. And again, it's all about how they process it to get the oil out of the avocado.
Are you saying there's good and bad avocado oils?
Yeah, there's some that are more the expeller pressed, and are they using heat and this kind of thing. And I'm still doing my due diligence to find a cleaner source of avocado oil, meaning that I'm more trusting of how they extract it. Like all the other companies that are out there, like Spectrum, for example, is a good company that they're going to tell you that it's expeller pressed. That doesn't mean that it's healthy. They're just trying to be more deliberate about letting you know that how is that extracted.
And then
you have to make a choice on, is this something I want or not? But avocado oil, generally, we just use that for high temperature cooking. So it's not something, and you're kind of destroying an oil, potentially making oil go rancid when you heat it, right? Like olive oil. Using olive oil to cook at high temperature is bad. You're gonna hit the smoke point of the olive oil, and then it starts to go rancid.
Hmm.
So now that's even worse than eating the seed oil to begin with, if that makes sense. Because now you're consuming rancid oil. And that's the problem with some of the seed oils too, is are they rancid before I get them? What's their shelf life? How did you extract them? And we don't have all those answers.
So do you use a lot less oil than you think most other households do as a result?
Probably. We have avocado oil, we have extra virgin olive oil. So those are the two that we use. And I would say the cooking part, I mean, we'll cook lower temperature, we'll cook with butter, we will cook with avocado oil if it's at higher temperature. So it's kind of based on the temperature in which we're cooking
at. What you're using
it
for, yeah.
Right, so if you're doing high heat and you're using a clean oil at high heat, more than likely you're destroying that oil.
Mm-hmm.
So that's knowing the smoke point or knowing when it's going to, you just, if you heat any oil long enough, even at lower temperature, you may eventually hit that. Well, I shouldn't say at any temperature. Length of time and temperature makes a difference on when it's going to smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And then now it's rancid. Now you take flaxseed oil and you heat it, you've destroyed it.
Okay.
Like, don't do that.
Interesting.
Right? That's why it's in a dark bottle. It's in the refrigerator. You need to keep it that way because it's not very stable. Because it's got more double bonds in it, right, compared to other oils or fats. So those are the two oils that I have. We use butter. We use lard. So lard is used. So, mm-hmm. you know, render our own lard. So I consider that to be cleaner, right? Now, if we're talking saturated fat, but I'm not using that as a definition. It's what did I do to get the lard?
Mm-hmm.
I use a crock pot, and I heat it up at low temperature, and then you're getting the fat that way.
Right.
And so I can do it in my kitchen. The olive oil, if I had a screw press and you gave me olives, I could create that in my kitchen.
Indeed.
Avocados, maybe, right? I've seen how they've, you know, gotten avocado oil. It kind of looks like you could probably extract that yourself.
And again, if you're using less of it, then you can also argue that.
Moderation. Oh, I don't eat that much.
Right. Sugar?
Sugar. So sugar is a big deal. So sugar, I'm a 25 pounds a year guy. That's my goal. Mm-hmm. It's kind of been between 15 and 25 pounds of sugar. If you go back to like the 1830s, that's when we were, our average consumption of sugar per capita was about 25 pounds a year.
Per person.
Now understand, if you were wealthy, you ate more sugar.
Right.
Because it was expensive, right? It's not expensive now. So now we eat 113 pounds, 172 pounds, depends on what you count as sugar.
Mm.
I count fruit juice as sugar, so I would add that to that list.
And so
that number, that 113, may be a bit higher.
Are you actually tallying the amount of sugar you eat during
the
year?
Okay, so think about this. This is my Little House on the Prairie perspective. I think about Little House on the Prairie when they're living out in the prairie and they go to the general store to buy the sugar because they didn't have I suppose they had honey that they could collect.
Maple syrup.
And maple syrup, yep. But the other sugar, they would go to the little corner
store,
the general store, and buy their sugar. And again, it was expensive. I don't know the exact price, but it was much more expensive than it is now. So they're going to have to ration it, and they ration it because of cost. So you go and you say, okay, well, I'm going to buy this much sugar, and it's going to sit in our cabinet because it's going to last for a long period of time in our pantry, and then I'll use it sparingly over the next 3 months or whatever that is. So honestly, I look at this and I say, okay, so if 25 pounds is the amount of sugar I can eat a year, that means on January 1st, I go out and buy 25 pounds of sugar and it goes in the pantry. And then if I'm using sugar, as long as it's coming from that, then I know that I've hit my 25 pounds, or I can ration that over an entire year. Now understand, I go outside, I go to the co-op, I stop at wherever, and I buy some ice cream. Now all of a sudden, that number's changed because I've lost the control of that. But not much.
It seems like it would be negligible.
Well, you could do that, but I'm just saying kind of theoretically that's what I'm trying to do, that I'm trying to understand how much sugar is in the things that I eat. And I don't buy the 25-pound sugar.
I was going to say, I really want to hear.
But I want to be aware of what I'm eating and what do I count as sugar. So I don't count a piece of fruit, as sugar.
Because it has all the other things around it. It's a whole food.
It's still sugar in there, though, right?
Sure.
I mean, at the end of the day, sugar is sugar. Or if we're talking sucrose or fructose, if we're being really biochemical about it, then we need to be clear on that. So I don't buy the 25 pounds, but I'm very aware of what the sugar is. And I don't count fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Fruit juice counts,
mm-hmm.
but I really don't drink fruit juice.
Right.
Dried fruit counts. I would count dried fruit as a sugar source.
Okay.
And then anything that's then added. I would count honey. I would count maple sugar, maple syrup. That's sugar. It's just a different form. Maybe it's more natural and it's got some beneficial properties in it, but the sugar is the sugar.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get around that part. So again, the idea is that's 25 pounds a year. Do you know what that translates to per day?
No, I'm wondering, how do you actually keep track of this, right?
Well, I keep track of it in my head, right? So that also means that I'm not definitive, like I could tell you I only ate 24.32 pounds of sugar last year, right?
Or even month by month, you're not saying,
not
right?
even month by month. But I have a general theme that's what I'm going for. But 25 pounds of sugar a year translates to about 30 grams a day. I think it's just under 30 grams, if you do the math on that.
Interesting.
That means I have 30 grams of sugar that I can eat per day. And it's funny. Now, again, I have an 11-year-old who's counting his sugar. But understand he's 11. When he's 14, he'll be counting his sugar the other way, right? He'll tell me how much he was eating instead of like, oh, I don't want to eat too much sugar, right? So I'm brainwashing. He's being brainwashed properly now, I guess.
Yeah.
Educated, what have you,
yes.
right? I mean, all three of my children, I can tell you, they can give you the reasons why not to drink soda. Because I've learned that if I want my children to learn something or know something, I need to repeat it 55 times or whatever it is.
Oh, okay.
So I keep repeating it over and over and over. But yet, They'll still drink soda, even though they know everything that's wrong.
But they'll hear your voice in their head.
Yeah,
that's what
maybe.
I think.
And then
about.
They'll be in counseling when they're 40, and they'll be like, "My dad made me."
Or maybe when they do start to experience an issue or a problem, they'll say, "Hey, come on, my dad's been telling me this for years. I finally got to act on it."
So I have to share the Halloween Goblin story because this is an appropriate time. So with my two older boys, it was always the Halloween Goblin came by on Halloween. So the Halloween Goblin would trade. Oh boy, my other son's going to listen to this. Oh, I got to make sure I'm going to have to edit this out before he hears it because I'm tipping my hand. My 11-year-old still believes in the Halloween Goblin.
Right, right.
So the Halloween Goblin comes and he trades. They put their candy out on the doorstep and the Halloween Goblin trades it.
We have a Halloween fairy.
Yes. Halloween fairy. Yeah, mm-hmm. I have the Goblin.
Boys
Anyways,
versus girls.
And the more you put out, the bigger the toy you'll get. Mm-hmm. And honestly, with Halloween, I'm like, just if you're going to binge eat it, do it now and it needs to be gone. I don't want it in the house. It needs to be out of this house. So do it, be done. And so the Halloween Goblin comes. And so for my boys, they would put it out and they never liked the toys that they got. And I remember the one year, and it was my nephew was there. So all three of them got it. And I still hear the traumatic experience of, wow, I got like six packs of football cards for all that candy I put out. Do you know how much work I went through to get all of that candy?
Oh.
So I will hear this story from my older boys that the Halloween Goblin, and they get this, you like they're having
so
an anxiety
excited.
Attack when they hear about the Halloween Goblin.
Yeah.
They're like, that was a bad experience.
They were so excited at the time, but then
they were
learned.
So excited, and then it was, oh my goodness, huge I traded letdown. All my candy for six packs of football cards. Oh. This is a bad deal.
Right.
So they don't let me live that one down.
Well, Paul, do you have any closing thoughts about this idea of who is an expert?
Who,
in nutrition.
Yeah, I don't know. You are the expert. So the expert is again, put the mirror up and say, okay, here's some tendencies. We can run an experiment. Let's run an experiment. But then you have to tell me. Right, this is about the empowerment of you saying, hey, I can change whatever I want, but what am I expecting to get from this?
Great. Right,
is this improving? And how do I know that it's improving my health? Am I just going by my weight? Is it just by my blood pressure? Is it just by my cholesterol? I'm saying let's not ignore those, but that's not the whole picture. It's all that subjective experience of energy level, fatigue, waking rested in the morning, you know, all these
And sustainability, that psychology of, hey, I'm doing this and I'm actually sustaining it. I'm successful.
Yeah. And
I love the metaphor of the dance.
Yeah. And so we've got to engage that dance for the long term. And how do we work that? And what does that look like? And that's something that you have to figure out. I can't tell you what that dance is going to be.
Thank you so much, Paul Rattay. We're here at the Radio Free Space on WDRT, The Skeptical Naturopath. I'm Christina DeRocher, and I thank you very much for tuning in. We'll see you next month.